Hey, you guys, movie retrospective time, and we're talking Stephen King adaptations. One of the good ones.
Yeah. There are some good ones.
There are. No, I said one of the good ones.
Yeah, yeah.
There are several good ones. I know that, like, a lot of people shit on, like, Stephen King adaptations, but there are a significant number of good ones, and this is one of the best ones. Matter of fact, Stephen King, I don't know how he feels about it nowadays, but he has many times said that this is in his top 10 favorite adaptations.
Movie kind of holds up over the years, too. It's still good.
It really does. I mean, and this came out back in 1990.
Yeah.
And it was directed by Rob Reiner. Now, Rob Reiner, obviously, you know, he started out as an actor. He was on All in the Family, but then went on to do, like, a lot of really iconic, directing a lot of really iconic movies. He did This Is Spinal Tap. He did The Princess Bride, which was fucking fantastic. And he also did Stand By Me, which was also a Stephen King adaptation. So I think that him doing that was one of the things that made Stephen King, like, excited to see what he would do with Misery. Because I think at first, like, when Stephen King wrote Misery, like, the book came out in 87, I think. And I think he was initially going to publish it under his pseudonym, Richard Bachman, just because it was a real, I don't know, I guess it was one of, like, a very personal story for him. I think I've read that it came from, like, a dream that he had, like, about being trapped in a house and, like, forced to write a book, like, by some crazy lady that was, like, wandering around in there. So I kind of feel like that's why. Now, this movie is kind of the same as the book, but I will say in the book, the writer, Paul Sheldon, is a lot less sympathetic, and the character of Annie Wilkes is much, much, much crazier. So it's just, like, it's a lot more violent, like, a lot more fucked up shit happens, but the whole of the book pretty much takes place inside the house and inside Paul Sheldon's head, whereas the movie kind of made the wise decision, because it's a movie and not a book, of kind of expanding the world out a little bit, although it is, like, still pretty claustrophobic, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like Rob Reiner, like, he said that before he made the movie that he watched a bunch of, you know, he was a big Hitchcock fan, but he watched a bunch of Hitchcock movies, and he said in particular he really liked the very Hitchcockian thing where they would kind of, like, do close-ups on, like, hands and objects and stuff like that. So they do a lot in this one. Like, here's this little cigarette, and here's this little match, and here's this other kind of stuff. So he wanted it much more like a straight-ahead, like, suspense film rather than the book, which is more like a much darker, like, psychological film. So, yeah, so this came out in 1990. Fun fact, this is, as far as I know, the only Stephen King adaptation to have ever won an Oscar. And that Oscar went to Kathy Bates, who played Annie Wilkes. And this was actually her first major role. She started out as a stage actress, I believe. And this was, like, the first major role that she was in. I think the first people that they asked to do that role were Angelica Houston, which might have been good, and Bette Midler. Mm. Which, that might have worked out. I don't know.
No.
Bette Midler later said she was sad that she hadn't taken it, because she thought it would have been a lot of fun.
No, this is the casting was correct in this case. This
I mean, woman, she's perfect in this.
Yeah, she fits the role real well. She's a weird-looking woman physically, in a way. I don't want to say that in a weird way. Because what I mean by weird is that she's stocky and kind of meaty. She's not fat, but she kind of looks physically strong, like a woman that's worked. And she can go from fucking real frightening looking, and she can go from real frightening looking in her face, and then real sweet and angelic, and pretty actually. And she can do it in the fucking drop of a dime. You know what I mean? It's like, damn. So she could just seem real angelic, and then get real demonic, and then go back to being angelic and innocent. Just fucking, she's fucking creepy. Real creepy.
I think that's one of the things that made her one of the iconic movie villains is just because she came off so much. I mean, she comes off very, like, sheltered, and she's, you know, they clearly portray her, like, maybe more so in the movie than the book, but they kind of, like, portray her as very, like, religious, very golly-gee, aw shucks kind of person.
1950s.
Yeah, very, very, like I said, very sheltered, very, she doesn't swear and anything like that. So, and she comes across as just, like, like, she's never been out of this little town, and
she's playing Patty Duke, kind of.
A little bit.
Patty Duke, and then she goes satanic, and then goes back to fucking Patty Duke, fucking, which there was some weird duality in Patty Duke, too, fucking, what happened to her, but, you know, kind of some parallels there in a certain way where, you know, I don't know, she wasn't an abuser, though, she was abused, but fucking, yeah, this is, she sells this role, she sells this character, you believe it.
You're like, yeah. And like I said, I kind of feel like this is how, I mean, this was her first major role and she got an Oscar for it, so I think that this is really what kind of, I mean, she was in another Stephen King movie later on, she was in Dolores Claiborne, she was also great in that, and, you know, she didn't get typecast in horror because she was in, like, a lot of different kind of movies, but, I mean, nowadays she's on American Horror Story, so she's, like, all, or she was, like, some of the... I don't know. I haven't seen some of the later seasons, so I don't know if she's still on there. But she was on there for a little while, but this was kind of like where it started. And I think that, I mean, like I said, she really kind of sells that duality where you could totally buy at first. You're just like, oh, thank goodness, like this woman saved me and she happened to be a nurse and everything like that. But then slowly, you know, James Caan's character like starts to realize, he's like, oh no, like I'm up shit creek, like because she is clearly... crazy.
Yeah.
And the implication too, they don't, and I like that they didn't really spell this out, but when he escapes from his room like that one time and finds her scrapbook, they imply in there, well, it's not implied, it's like they pretty much shows it, but it's like she started, well, she's a serial killer, I mean, yeah, you know, we'll say that right now, but it looks like she started real early. Like, because it says, like, her dad, she has a thing that her dad got killed when she was still a kid. Like, I think he, like, fell down the stairs or fell off a building or something. You're meant to, to kind of, like, get that she did it. And then, like, later on when she was in nursing school, like, the top student at the nursing school, she also fell down some stairs or fell off a building or something accidentally. So
all the missing all the dead babies.
Yeah, so you kind of get, like, this idea about...
her husband.
Yeah, she killed her husband as well, but she always gets off with it because she kind of makes it look like an accident. So it's almost kind of like, it's really interesting because they give her this kind of unspoken backstory where, you know, she seems really nice and sweet and matronly, like, on the surface, but then, like, she will absolutely, if you're in her way or, you know, you're doing something she doesn't like, she will absolutely, like, take you out and she will probably get away with it.
She's one of those old school cases like we've covered in other shows, one of those Angel of Death type serial killers.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Munchausen by proxy, kind of. But they tend to work in hospitals, and they tend to kill patients, you know, and that's what they do.
And that's what she does on this,
and they
too.
Pass
like,
it off.
It seems like she kills people. Well, it's implied that she killed people to get to the position of head nurse of the maternity ward, perhaps specifically for the purpose of killing the babies.
Yeah,
like you said,
over 200 of them in one place, wasn't it?
I don't know if it was that many.
Was
no, 200? I think it was like a dozen or
a
something
dozen? Okay.
Like
that. I thought
that.
They said 200. Okay.
No, like that, yeah, that she would be like, that would be real suspicious.
Yeah.
But I mean, she did get arrested, but then she got acquitted. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So she still had this kind of like, but she, I don't know, she's just like, she was always able to get away with it because she always kind of operated with.
Might have fucked my memory up because in one of those cases we covered before, that woman killed a couple hundred. Remember? Back in the late 1800s,
well, that was
early 1900s.
Well, that might have been Amelia Dyer.
Yeah, I think that's what I was thinking of.
I don't remember how many she killed, but yeah, it was a lot. But I think in the movie, I think it was only like I think it was like 9 or 12 or something.
I'm getting it. Might be confused. The woman who was running the so-called adoption agency where they were giving up their babies and she was just tossing them in the Thames.
Yeah, that's who that was.
Yeah, she had a couple hundred of them.
Yeah. I didn't remember, like, I thought we did a show about her, but I don't know if we did or not, because I remember, like, wanting to a show about her, but I don't know if we ever did. But so, yeah, so she's kind of like a character like that, but I also want to go into, too, because I feel like this movie, like, I feel like everybody has either, like, seen the movie or read the book or both or something like that, but if you don't know, it's basically, the long and short of the plot is Paul Sheldon, he's a writer, he writes, like, these real cheesy romance novels, which he can't stand, but they make him, like, shit tons of money, but he's not really getting a lot of artistic thing out of it.
No, he writes romance novels, man.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, you know, it's like not really what he wants to write. That's just how he makes money. So he writes like what he wanted to write, like this artistic, more kind of like gritty kind of book about like kids in slums and stuff like that, like kind of more from his experience. And he's taking it to his agent, Like, he stays at this cabin in Colorado, like, when he's writing. He's taken to his agent, he gets in a wreck, and Annie Wilkes pulls him out of the snow, pulls him out of the car, and it so happens that she's not only a nurse, but she's also his number one fan. And even though at first she seems like, yeah, she actually sets his legs and, you know, she has all this medication, she has all the stuff and she feeds him and everything like that. But as the story goes on, it becomes clear that she's not going to let him leave.
No, she got a whole nurse station at her house.
Yeah, which I'm assuming she just, like, stole from the, yeah, because she had, like, all the
pharmacy.
Drugs and all that stuff.
Got a whole pharmacy.
Handy.
she didn't have a hospital bed, but she had wheelchairs, and she had, like, an IV bottles and, like, and hypos, and she could set legs and shit.
For just such occasions. You never know, like, when somebody is just kind of, like, going to come
Well, some people who are really into professions, you know, they have things from their profession in their house, of course, but she was a sinister figure. She would steal shit.
Yeah.
Drugs and stuff to have a pharmacy at her house. Probably not to do stuff like this. It's just probably just pathological behavior of stealing things.
Yeah.
Just so she could have her power at her place. Because she didn't evidently do this regularly, you know.
It's like she wasn't planning on it. Yeah, well, the thing about it, because I can't remember, because it's been a while since I've read the book, but I think in the book and in the movie they kind of say this too, because you might think, well, it's like, wow, what a coincidence that she just happened to, like, find her favorite writer or something like that. It wasn't a coincidence. She lived around there, and she knew that he had stayed in that hotel or that lodge or whatever when he was working on the book, so she stalked him. Because she knew he was there. But he never knew she was around. But then it so happened that she was following him when he got in the wreck. So she was right there. So she'd been, like, following him and stalking him for some time and, like, knew everything about him. So I kind of feel like, yeah, so she seems nice at first. But then she picks up the book that the last Misery Chastain book that he wrote. And he's, like, so sick of writing that shit that he killed off the main character, right? And so, but then that book came out, and she reads it, and as soon as she gets to the end and that character's dead, oh boy, she gets really, really upset. Because her whole entire life is, I mean, she's a very lonely person, obviously, so her whole entire life is kind of, like, wrapped up in these fictional romances and in this character, and now that he killed the character off, she is just, like, not fucking having it.
I read the book when I was a kid, but I don't remember all of it. But I do remember that the book, that the movie was pretty accurate to the book, and they did a good job of giving her kind of characterization. And in her house, she has shrines built of people that guys that she was in love with, and she was in love with him. She had a shrine built to him. The writer, and she had a shrine built to Liberace.
Now, that was a movie-only edition.
It was?
They actually added that for the movie.
It was great in a movie.
Yeah.
It was great in a movie, but if I remember correctly,
Liberace
she had a shrine to shrines in her house.
Paul Sheldon,
I was a kid when I read it, yeah.
Yeah.
The Liberace touch was fucking great, because there were women like that from her.
Yeah.
That was something that was from a generation before her time, actually, you know, like my grandmother's era and shit, you know, they were big into that dude. But she, you know, she was kind of considered herself, I guess, to be traditional and old-fashioned.
Yeah, that's exactly and I think that was a good choice, like, for the...
She would have liked either Liberace or Elvis, you know.
Yeah. And like I said, I think some of that was added for the movie. I don't remember, like I said, it's been a while since I've read the book, but I think that the Annie in the book was just a lot more... was, like, a lot more just, like, straight-up psychopath.
Yeah.
And she did a lot worse shit in the book. Like, they actually toned it down for the movie because they wanted to make her scary, but they also wanted to make her, like, a little bit pathetic, like, a little bit sympathetic, so people would... Yeah, so...
Well, that's what Liberace's female fans were. Look, man, fucking be honest. Liberace was just fucking... His fans were basically millions of fag hags. They were old ladies, single old ladies, that fucking loved Liberace on a romantic level. And they knew he was gay. They had to have. But there's something about loving the unattainable and fucking... And maybe there was, like, some kind of a fucking recognition of fucking unrequited love going in two different directions. They would never get what they wanted, and he would never get what they wanted because they were not compatible, but there was something about old women being romantically in love with Liberace, and it was a it was a weird thing. One of my old babysitters when I was a little kid was just in love with Liberace. She was a nice woman though, but she was an old babe, you know.
Yeah, she probably didn't kill anybody that we know of.
No, she's an old, but that was, and it was, you know, these were people old. These were women that were older than say like my mom back in the '70s. They were older than my mom, so it was either Liberace or Elvis. Weird, but. And another one that was weird, who was one of Liberace's fag hags, was fucking Evel Knievel. I'll never fucking understand. Evel Knievel had this fucking fascination with Liberace, seeing, you know, living in the same hotels with him at the casinos and shit before the shows and shit. There's a lot of interviews of fucking who's the most alpha fucking manly man of all of his era, fucking Evel Knievel. There would never be a dude like that again, talking shit like crazy. Loved Liberace. You would, you know, nothing in common with him, but just, you know, strange.
Well, like I said, I think that was, if I'm not mistaken, William Goldman, the guy that wrote the screenplay, like wrote the adaptation, who's also wrote the wonderful novel, The Princess Bride, and wrote the screen adaptation for that as well. I think that was his idea, like making her like Liberace, which, like I said, was like a perfect touch, like for her character, because she's exactly the type woman that would be obsessed with romance novels and obsessed with a romance novel writer.
Yeah.
And she would have kind of delusions that she was in love with him and that he could love her back.
Yeah.
Now, when she seemed to have like some kind of like bipolar situation going on in the movie, because a lot of the times, you know, she was like talked about how she loved him and everything like that. But when she was in one of her down periods, she did seem to understand that it's like, you know, I know you don't love me back, and that's, you know, and so she kind of seemed to like be clued into the reality, but most of the time
she was in denial most of the time.
She was in denial
fantasy
most
world.
Of the time. Yeah.
But it was a great character. She did a great job. She you know, fucking, she deserved an Oscar for it.
She definitely did. Like I said, she's very, very, and the thing I love too about her, and I think this is a little bit from the book, because I do remember some of the book, like where she was real weird about swearing. And matter of fact, I think that was the first time in the movie where you saw the other side of her, because up until now she'd been like completely sweet and like she was taking care of him and he was like appreciating and everything like that. But then when she read his other book that wasn't like the Misery book and it was just all full of swearing and stuff like that, she was basically like, you know, this isn't the way people talk and all this other kind of stuff. Because like I said, she's lived in a small town all her life, presumably, and she doesn't know like how other people live, I guess. So she's just talking about, so then she just goes off on this big fucking rant about, you know, you think I go to the feed store and say, hey, there's that bitchly cow. So she like has like all these really funny like swear words.
Yeah. It was great though.
Yeah.
The movie and so was the book, especially when you grew up on the edges of this era. People weren't dumb back then, but a lot of people were very sheltered. There was no social media or internet. Everything, the environment was highly controlled through television and mass media that was heavily censored in the United States. People were very low information. And if you lived out in the middle of nowhere, or if you were kind of on the edges of society, you could have a really distorted view of the way reality was. And you could lie yourself into the world of Patty Duke. That's the way people don't talk. People don't swear. Yeah, they do. And then I think with this character, because she's not really like that inwardly, she thinks of herself of even worse than what she is. So she's spiraling out of control, you know, because really she's a monster.
Yeah.
Kind of self-created partially. But she's in denial that she's a monster. Yeah. But then there's also something kind of sad about her. You know what I mean? You kind of feel bad about it.
Yeah, and I think that that's more, because like I said, in the book, you don't really feel sorry for her, because she comes across much more like as a psycho in the novel, and she does way worse shit. Matter of fact, in the book, she actually, you know, the very famous hobbling scene from the movie, which is horrific. I mean, it was just like so great the way it was like shot and everything, like the way it's framed was just so great. And it's just like, if you've seen it, like it made like a huge impact. But in the book, she actually cuts his foot off.
Yeah.
And then cauterizes it.
Yeah.
And they were gonna do that. like, William Goldman, who wrote the screenplay, is like, oh my god, we should totally do that. But then they were like, maybe we shouldn't, because it would make her less sympathetic. Like, it would make her more of a monster, because they wanted her to be a monster, but they also wanted her to be kind of pitiful. Right. And for the audience to kind of feel a little bit bad for her.
Yeah, they leave it open. They left it open in the book, too, if I remember correctly, though, too. Something must have happened to her when she was real young that sent her down this path of being a psychopath and killing people, and it didn't make her better, it made her worse. But she was trying to be, on the surface, a normal person. You know, something must have happened to her.
It wasn't working out.
And, you know, the movie kind of implies that, well, the first one she killed was maybe her father. There might have been some abuse there. So she had to fight to get herself out of that situation, and which sent her down a path of constantly fighting to get what she wanted. And then by the time you see her, and then evidently fucking marriage didn't work out, you know, because by then she was already kind of fucked up.
And then maybe the dude did something that pissed her off, maybe. And she's just like, boop.
Well, dude probably was going to leave.
Yeah.
You know, you're fucking crazy, bitch. I'm getting out of here. And,
I'll push you off a building if you call me crazy.
So when you meet her in the book and in the movie, she's a middle-aged woman living by herself, and she's, I think, retired, right? Is she retired, or is she just can't?
Yeah, work? I'm guessing she's retired. And well, she's I don't know, because I guess she had gone to, she was exonerated. They said that the trial was in Denver.
Right.
So, because it does take place in Colorado, but it's kind of like up in the mountains, like kind of out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, whatever it is, her career's over. It was ruined. And she has no prospects for fucking future relationships or romance with dudes, you know. The average woman, if you actually look at the statistics, after 40 is basically invisible. It just, by the way the mating process works between males and females. So a woman's lucky to get attention way into her 50s and almost rarely into her 60s. So she's a has-been living in the past, you know, and this is her last chance for something kind of like love. But it's only going to come out of the pages of this book from this writer that she's infatuated with, too. She kind of loves him, too, but he'll never love her back. You know what I mean? He could get a much younger woman, you know, fucking, who's not crazy, you know, fucking just. So she's a sad character.
Yeah.
You know? And they kind of make it known that, you know, she's got no future, especially from her point of view, you know, she's never going to get what she wants.
Yeah, and, well, like I said, so they made her a little bit more sympathetic, but I will say, too, that Paul Sheldon, the writer character, he's not really all that sympathetic in the book either.
He's a tough-ass motherfucker.
You know what I mean? So they actually made him more sympathetic. Now, interestingly, James Caan was not one of the first actors they asked to do this. Actually, they asked a whole panoply of actors to do it, and most of them didn't want to do it, I guess because the role is very static. I mean, pretty much the whole thing, you're having to, like, lay in a bed in one room.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people didn't really want to do that because they thought it was too passive a role, or they wouldn't be able to act that much or anything like that. But honestly, I'm really glad that James Caan got it because he does so much. His facial expressions in this are everything. Yeah. I mean, they're so, so good.
He does good. Caan was an old-time actor. Okay. He'd been around for a long time. Real famous for kind of like gangster and police type.
Yeah, movie. Tough guy kind of
tough
roles.
Guy stuff. So he's perfect in it. This is kind of like, in his generation, it would have been the equivalent of saying having like Sylvester Stallone or somebody like that playing this role. And he pulls it off, man. He does a good job. He's normally a tough guy, but he's in a position of weakness. Okay? If he could get out of bed, he could crush this woman's head. All right? But he's helpless. He's got to try to think his way out of this situation. Because she's not a weak woman. She's strong for a woman, okay? Especially for a woman her age. They make her look kind of meaty, you know what I mean?
Well, and she works on a farm.
She's
and
a
shit
farm
like
girl,
too.
Right.
So
she wouldn't be burly. A pushover. But James Caan could, you know, if he was fucking up on his feet and healthy, he could fucking knock her out easy. But not in this situation. So it's kind of like it's definitely like an emasculation fucking motif, you know what I mean? This isn't the normal order of things, all right? He can't get out of bed. She's keeping him in bed, keeping him weak, you know, and he's pissed.
Well, and it's at first it was just like the accident was just an accident, but it was like he broke both his legs, and I think he broke his arm too.
Yeah.
But then, like, once he starts, so he's there for like quite a long time. I think like the over the course of the book takes place over like several months. I can't even remember how long it is. But then, like, once he starts healing up, then she keeps him drugged. They don't really do that in the movie. Like, she gives him drugs in the movie, but they don't show at any point in the movie, I don't think, he becomes, like, addicted to the drugs. But in the book, he did. Like, he became dependent on them.
Yeah.
So, now, in the movie, he pretended to be, like, a few times if it suited his purposes, because he kept, like, asking for more of them so he could stockpile them so he could maybe poison her later.
He's in a position where Braun isn't gonna save him. It's going to have to be brains. So he tries to come up with all these plans of trying to outsmart this chick, which kind of works, but not really.
But the thing about it, though, is that most of them would have worked if not for various like little accidental things that happened. So that's what's so great, like with the suspense in it too, because that whole scene where he like spent all that time like saving up
the drugs,
like all those drugs, and then like he finally gets her, oh, have dinner with me, and he's like all pretending to be in love with her, and he's going to try and dope her, and then like she just like spills
drink,
and then he's like the look on his face is just like so like because he knows. Like, fuck, he's now like, I have to start over. And, like, all the shit about him just, like, you know, getting out of his room and having to, like, pretend that he's not. I mean, she's, you know, she's not stupid either. So she knows that he's been out, and she kind of, like, for a little while sort of strings him along and makes him think that she doesn't know about it. But I think in the book, she... If she suspected he was getting out, she would take pieces of her hair and tape them across like all the doors and things like that.
To see if he'd gone out.
See if he'd gotten out. Whereas in the movie, like it was just like a little like a penguin that she had, and he kind of like fell and dropped it. And when he put it back on the table, it wasn't in the exact same position, and so she noticed that it was in a different place. And then she was like, "Oh, well, we can't have you getting out of the room anymore." And that's when she fucking hobbled him. I think later on in the book too, I think she cuts one of his thumbs off.
It's been a long time since I read.
Yeah, I think she cuts one of his thumbs off, like, after... Like, he won't tell her how the book ends, because that's what happens. Like, she is so pissed that he killed off Misery, her favorite character, that she basically makes him burn the book that he wrote, you know, the non-Misery one, and then says, now you have to, like, write a book bringing Misery back from the dead. So she's forcing him to write it, which leads to kind of... That's one of my favorite scenes, too, is, like, when she's talking about... Like, the first go-around, when he tries to bring the character back from the dead, and she comes in, and she's like, it's not fair. And then she's talking about the chapter plays, and it's like how they always, like, cheated, you know what I mean? Like, with the guy jumped out of the car before. But she's like, that's not what happened, like, in last week. They didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car, you know what I mean? So it was just, like, that whole fucking scene. But the ironic thing about it, though, is that even though she's a nut... And she's forcing him to write a book that he doesn't want to write. It seems like her doing that, like, made him, like, really, like, write this really good book. You know what I mean? And in the book, I think it's, like, the book has kind of, like, a sadder ending. Because I feel like the movie, like, obviously he kills her in both the book and the movie. But in the book, after he gets away, he has, like, really, really bad PTSD, which, you know, understandably, and he becomes an alcoholic, and he's still, like, addicted to the drugs and everything like that, and then he gets pissed off because the Misery Returns book is, like, hugely, hugely popular, and he's just like, now I'm just right back where I started, where I have to, like, keep writing these shitty books forever. You know what I mean? So it's that kind of thing. So I think they tempered the end a little bit of the movie. It's not quite as cold-blooded. I mean, he does get away at the end of the book, and, like, he kills her, but... He's still kind of, like, stuck in, like, writing these books. And I think at the end, like, his agent said, well, why don't you write a book about, like, your experience, like, what happened to you? And maybe you can go off in a different way from there. But he is still stuck, like, writing these Misery books that he can't stand. So, in a way, like, the movie kind of, like, made it a little bit happier for him. Although it does kind of show that he has some kind of PTSD because he's in the restaurant and he sees a woman that... and he thinks it's her and shit like that. But I don't know. This was just... I think of all... This isn't my favorite Stephen King adaptation, but it's definitely up there. I think it's probably up there in the top five. I mean, I still can't believe that this is the only one that won an Oscar. Like I said, Kathy Bates won an Oscar for it. So Shawshank Redemption didn't win any Oscars? How can that be?
I haven't seen that in so long.
Man, Shawshank Redemption is awesome.
I remember liking it.
That's an awesome, awesome movie. And honestly, if we're gonna... There's been, like I said, a lot of good Stephen King adaptations. I'm gonna say probably Shawshank Redemption was the best one, but I don't know. It's kind of... I don't know. There was a lot of good ones, but I just can't believe... I'm pretty sure that that was nominated for an Oscar, but I'm just... I can't believe it didn't win. Was that the year that fucking Forrest Gump won?
I think it might have been around that time.
Yeah, maybe that's why. Maybe that's why.
What's weird about it is...
That's why everybody was mad at Forrest Gump.
Being Generation X, when you say Stephen King adaptation, I think of the shitty ones. That's what comes... That's what I remember. And I forget about how many good ones there were.
Yeah,
there
when
were probably
you start
better good ones than there were more good ones than there
that's
were bad
what
ones.
I mean, and I kind of feel like that it well it's weird because and I don't know why that is because I kind of have the same thing too.
Yeah.
And you'd think that I wouldn't have that because I've read most of his books and seen pretty much all the adaptations, and you'd think that most people, when you say Stephen King adaptations, like most people just like roll their eyes,
yeah,
like, oh, Jesus Christ. But then when you start thinking, oh, let's think of good ones, you can think of a fuck ton of good ones. And like you said, there's probably more good ones than shitty
ones.
Or at least, like, decent ones.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they're all, like, masterpieces, but there's a lot of really good ones.
Yeah. I think our opinion, our eye-rolling came about around the time of Maximum Overdrive and The Langoliers, around that time.
Probably.
Where they were like,
and it just kind of tainted the whole...
Yeah.
But there's been, like, so many good ones. Like I said, there's this one, there's Stand By Me, which is also Rob Reiner.
Even The Dark Half was good. It was thinner.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put that, like, in the top tier,
no.
But I think that's, like, B-Squad.
Okay, yeah, B-C Squad. They're still fun.
And then there's even ones that were decent that nobody even talks about, like Apt Pupil. That was, like, really decent.
I mean, there were some classic ones. Dead Zone, Firestarter, the old ones, they were, you know, they still hold up. They're very retro, but they hold up. They're fun to watch.
And I mean, I guess Creepshow isn't technically...
Yeah, it's got some Stephen King in it.
But it's got Stephen King in it. I mean, he did, like, write the stories. And Cat's Eye, I consider that a Stephen King adaptation because it's three of his short stories.
And I like the TV ones. I like the TV Stand. Somebody sent me a remastered Stand TV miniseries. It's good. A lot better than the VHS version. Looks a lot better. And I like the TV... Shining. It's
yes, we know.
She
you.
Didn't like
we
it.
We know
but
you did. Yeah, I don't
I
like
liked it.
I don't like it. I made a whole video on my other channel about that.
It was very... It's a lot closer to the book and than... well, you know, everybody likes fucking Kubrick's The Shining. It's a masterpiece.
I mean, pretty much 99% of people
I like that
like
one.
That one.
it's better artistically. But for a TV miniseries, if you don't have time to read the book... You can just watch the TV miniseries. It's pretty close to the book. It follows the general storyline follows it. I think exactly. I don't really think of it. I can't really think of anything where it departed. Not offhand. I'd like to see that again. Actually, is it as badass as fucking Kubrick? No. But it's closer to the book.
Yeah, like you said, if you had to do a book report and didn't have time to read the actual book, then
that's
one
what
would
you
be.
Do.
Yeah, don't watch the Stanley Kubrick one because
you'll never understand.
Because you'll get an F.
You'll never understand. You'll never understand what that book was about by watching Kubrick's movie. Even though Kubrick's movie was really the way to go when it comes to making a movie, but making a TV series, TV miniseries, I think it was went on for, I think it was like probably 6 hours, I think, maybe three. Because I can't remember how long each episode was. I thought they were little two-hour episodes, hour-and-a-half episodes. I think there were three of them, but it's been so long. No, the TV miniseries was exactly like it. But it drove people crazy. It sucks. But yeah, that was when the book. That's what it said in the book. And you know,
yeah, but like I said, that doesn't always work.
Doesn't translate too well to the screen.
It doesn't translate. Some things don't. Some things work out a lot better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Let's, you know, going in for another Stephen King example. I didn't mind the book Dreamcatcher, but the movie was fucking stupid.
Yeah.
Alien worms that come out your butt are, you can't put that in a movie and expect to be taken seriously.
No.
I'm sorry, you can't. Like, ass weasels or whatever the fuck they were.
Ass weasels.
I think they even called them that, like, in the book. Like, even in the book, I was just kind of like, really, King? You're kind of, like, going a little backwards. But then they made a movie out of it. I'm like, they did not. They did. Oh, my God. How did they do that? But, yeah.
Stephen King trolls.
The thing about
it,
he does, yeah.
He's a troll.
Well, the thing about it, and what I was going to say a little bit about Misery, too, is that I feel like, because he had sort of, like, a nightmare that sort of inspired this, I think what he was getting at, and he had, you know, this was... like right around the mid to late 80s when he wrote Misery, And I think he was getting to a point where he was so big and so famous that he was getting to a point where you're getting into what they would nowadays call toxic fandom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think that him writing this book was almost like purging these feelings about becoming trapped by your fan base and your fan base feeling like they have a control over you, or they have ownership of what you make, of what you create. Yeah. And so I think that he was really struggling with that, and it came out as Misery, as the character of Annie Wilkes, who was like the ultimate number one fan, but who absolutely wants to control every single aspect of what you're creating. And if you do something she doesn't like, then she'll cut your feet off. You know what I mean? Like, it's obviously an extreme example, but I think that's kind of what he was talking about, was like toxic fandom.
Yeah, I was thinking about what the worst Stephen King adaptation was. And some people would say Langoliers, but I was thinking about, the worst one was The Gunslinger.
Lawnmower Man.
Yeah,
although he sued to take his name off
that was not a thing. I would say that The Gunslinger, that was the fucking worst. There was just nothing in that even close to what that fucking book was, and they just dumb. The Gunslinger is a whole fucking universe of shit. That would have to be a long running series to get that story told. There never should have been a movie about The Gunslinger.
Not a one-off. No. I mean, that was a dumb idea.
Dumb.
And like I said, and the thing about it is that Stephen King has written how many billion books now and stories?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
There's a universe. And there's a Stephen King universe.
That's what I'm saying.
Make the MCU blush. And so all those books are connected.
Thing about it is that, as you know, as many of his books and stories have been adapted, there's a fuck ton that haven't been that I'm always kind of like perplexed about, because especially like I like a lot of his short stories, to be honest, and I think a lot of those would actually make really good movies, but for whatever reason some of my favorite ones like never did get adapted. I don't really know why.
I forgot to send you the link to that YouTube video where that maps out the Stephen King universe, how all the books are connected.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'll make sure to send it to you. But it's on the YouTube. You guys can look it up. It's good.
Yeah, because I told you to send me that.
It shows how they're connected and where the things are mentioned, and it's a whole damn universe he's built as he went. And pretty much all of those books are connected. I think the only thing that wasn't connected was, he didn't say anything about the Talisman. I would think that the Talisman would be connected somehow.
Well, I mean, I know he definitely has a thing where he makes reference to other characters.
Yeah, in other books.
Like, in other books. Well, because, which most of them are set, like, around, you know, in that part of Maine or whatever. Not this one. Misery is actually set in Colorado, just like The Shining is. But like I said, I think that Stephen King used to spend a lot of time in Colorado. Like, I think he vacationed out there or something like that. So a lot of his stuff is, like, set out there as well. But all the stuff set in Maine, like, he usually in his books, like, puts little Easter eggs. Of, like, they'll refer to some character or somebody like that that was in, like, another story.
He's good. I mean, he had some bad spots, but he kind of made little comebacks and stuff. Wasn't big on. I kind of started to check out around the Tommyknockers time of reading it. Yeah, life took over too. I was getting older, had to move off into the army world and shit. Fucking didn't have time to read books. But when you're a kid back in those days, pre-internet, you could sit around and read books at night before you went to bed. You know.
Well, I still
you didn't have all those. I have too many distractions. No, I don't really have time.
Well, you have to make yourself.
Yeah, I don't really enjoy it anymore, especially since head injuries.
I mean, the thing about it, though, and I've mentioned this before, but the Stephen King book from 2014, which is called Revival, which I just kind of bought at a secondhand bookstore, you would probably actually really dig that. It was, like, really, really good. I was surprised.
I can't mechanically enjoy reading anymore, because as my eyes scan across the written page, my eyeballs will jump to another line, so then I have to fucking go back and read. I end up reading the same sentences two or three times over. It's real frustrating, and it's... I can read, it's just that I can't control where my eyeballs are landing on the page. It's hard for me to track across, and it makes me jump back up to the top just because of the fucking frontal head injuries.
You can do audiobooks.
Yeah, audiobooks I can do.
You'd probably be into that. I know a lot of people like, because a guy, Dominic Noble, who has his channel I watch, he usually does audiobooks because he has dyslexia, so he has a hard time reading books, like, without all the... letters rearranging themselves.
Yeah.
So so he usually listens to audiobooks. I'm personally, I like to read books. If I have like an audiobook going, my mind starts to wander, like, cuz yeah. I don't really particularly enjoy just like listening to people talk. And I know, like, a lot of people do, like, podcasts and stuff, but I don't usually listen to those because I just start thinking about other stuff and I'm not listening to the person anymore.
I noticed that if the print is bigger, my eyes can track the lines.
Well, that's why they make those big.
Yeah, so I'd have to get, like, fucking super old man books.
Like, the old man book.
It's just fucking, you know what I mean?
There's, like, one word on every page. It's like this.
But after my accident, I fucking just got so frustrated. It got better over the years, you know? But it took about 10 years for it to, but it's still just, every now and then, I just get in this frustrating loop of reading the same fucking line over and over again, and you can't pull my eye off of it. It's just something that happened to me. I might be able to go through four paragraphs normally and then get stuck at one spot, and I'll read that same sentence three or four times, and then I'll get frustrated and throw the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that Stephen King has written some newer shit that is absolutely good and absolute. And I really, and actually, producers out there, if anybody wants to make Revival into a movie, like, somebody should do that, because that would be an excellent movie, I think. Like I said, it was very, it was almost like Frankenstein, but also like Ray Bradbury kind of thing, too. So I was like really into it. But yeah, so I can't imagine that anybody watching this has not seen and or read Misery. But if you haven't, I mean, fucking do it. What the hell are you even like waiting for? The book and the movie are similar, but like I said, the book is much more like, the characters are less sympathetic and it's a lot gorier. Like in the movie, like, just the cop just gets shot, whereas in the book, like, he gets run over with a fucking lawnmower or something like that. It's a lot more gruesome, and a lot worse shit happens. But I think the movie, like, in making it less gruesome, I think it did a good job in making it more suspenseful and also gave it kind of like a Blackly comic kind of tone to it, which I think really worked. So, you know, they're different, but I think it like worked out really well. And again, like, I think Kathy Bates absolutely deserved that Oscar. So, yeah.
Strangely sexy woman. Strangely. Weird. Not my type at all.
See it. You talk about me having like saying like, weird looking people are sexy, but it's like it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
You can't explain it. Don't try to explain it. It's
definitely
okay.
Not my type. There's just something strangely magnetic about that woman.
Well, evidently a lot of people thought that, because she gets work like all the time.
Yeah,
because she's a great actress too. I mean, I have to say, but yeah. So at the moment, Misery. We'd watched it on Shudder. Shudder just added a fuck ton of Stephen King adaptations, the good ones like Cat's Eye, and I think they added Needful Things and Salem's Lot and a bunch of other ones. But I'm sure it's like streaming other places too, because it's, you know, one of those classic movies.
I really recommend Salem's Lot.
Yeah, that's also on there.
It
too.
It was made for TV.
The TV
really
made
good.
For TV one, but yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah, it's definitely.
It makes a very long movie, but it's good. It's good vampire movie.
I'm surprised they haven't redone that one, or have they?
No. Yeah, they did another version of it that kind of flopped. It was supposed to be closer to the book, evidently, but it just no. There's part of Salem's Lot is the way they made Mr. Barlow look. He looked like Nosferatu.
Yeah, which I
think. And he didn't say anything, but he said stuff in the book. But because they changed it, it actually makes it better on screen.
Yeah, definitely.
The Barlow didn't say anything, just pointed like that. And he had his fucking servant doing it all. What was his name? Mr. Manfred or whatever his name was? Or I don't know. British guy.
I don't know. James Mason was playing.
Yeah, yeah. He had him talking for him.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're a vampire, you're like, I'm too cool to talk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All right. So, yeah. Go watch Misery if you haven't seen it. Or, you know, talk about it in the comments. Whatever. Discuss among yourselves. And we will see you guys on the next movie retrospective. Bye.